Chapter 36. Them to be well grounded in that great and useful game. You cannot learn it well when you are old, any more than you can learn dancing or billiards. In our house at home, we youngsters did not play whist because we were dear obedient children, and the elder said playing at cards was waste of time. A waste of time, my good people. Allens. What do elderly homekeeping people do of a night after dinner? Darby gets his newspaper, my dear Joan, her missionary magazine, or her volume of coming sermons, and don't you know what ensues? Over the arm of Darby's armchair the paper flutters to the ground unheeded, and he performs the trumpet obligato cave aus savas on his old nose. My dear old Joan's head nods over her sermon awakening, though the doctrine may be ding, ding, ding. Can that be 10 o'clock? It is time to send the servants to bed, my dear, and to bed master and mistress go to. But they have not wasted their time playing at cards. Oh, no. I belong to a club where there is whist of a night, and not a little amusing is it to hear Brown speak of Thompson's play, and vice versa. But there is one man greater ex, let us call him, who is the acknowledged captain and primus of all the whist players. We all secretly admire him. I, for my part, watch him in private life, hearken to what he says, note what he orders for dinner, and have that feeling of awe for him that I used to have as a boy for the cock of the school. Not play at whist? Uel Christ viles vos vos prepres, were the words of the great and good Bishop of Aden. I can't. It is too late now. Too late. Too late. Ah. Humiliating confession. That joy might have been clutched, but the life stream has swept us by it, the swift life stream rushing to the nearing sea. Too late. Too late. 20 stone, my boy. When you read in the papers all say do tempts, and all the fashionable dances taught to adults by his lightfoots, don't you feel that you would like to go in and learn? Ah, it is too late. You have passed the Joyous Master 20 stone, and the young people are dancing without you. I don't believe much of what my Lord Byron the poet says, but when he wrote, so for a good old gentlemanly vice, I think I shall put up with avarice, I think his lordship meant what he wrote, and if he practiced what he preached, shall not quarrel with him. As an occupation in declining years, I declare I think saving is useful, amusing, and not unbecoming. It must be a perpetual amusement. It is a game that can be played by day, by night, at home and abroad, and at which you must win in the long run. I am tired, and want a cab. The fare to my house, say, is 2 shillings. The cabman will naturally want half a crown. I pull out my book. I show him the distance is exactly 3 miles and 1,590 yards. I offer him my card, my winning card. As he retires with the 2 shillings, blaspheming inwardly, every curse is a compliment to my skill. I have played him and beat him, and a sixpence is my spoil and just reward. This is a game, by the way, which women play far more cleverly than we do. But what an interest it imparts to life. During the whole drive home I know I shall have my game at the journey's end, I'm sure of my hand, and shall beat my adversary. Or I can play in another way. I won't have a cab at all, I will wait for the omnibus. I will be one of the damn 14 in that steaming vehicle. I will wait about in the rain for an hour, and bus after bus shall pass, but I will not be beat. I will have a place, and get it at length, with my boots wet through, and an umbrella dripping between my legs. I have a rheumatism, a cold, a sore throat, a sulky evening, a doctor's bill tomorrow perhaps? Yes, but I have won my game, and am gainer of a shilling on this rubber. If you play this game all through life, it is wonderful what daily interest it has, and amusing occupation. For instance, my wife goes to sleep after dinner over her volume of sermons. As soon as the dear soul is sound asleep, I advance softly and puff out her candle. Her pure dreams will be all the happier without that light, and, say she sleeps an hour, there is a penny gained. As for clothes, parbleu, there is not much money to be saved in clothes, For the fact is, as a man advances in life, as he becomes an ancient Briton, mark the pleasantry, he goes without clothes. When my tailor proposes something in the way of a change of raiment, I laugh in his face. My blue coat and brass buttons will last these 10 years. The CD? What then? I don't want to charm anybody in particular. You say that my clothes are shabby? What do I care? When I wish to look well in somebody's eyes, the matter may have been different. But now, when I receive my bill of 10L, let us say, at the year's end, and contrast it with old Taylor's reckonings, I feel that I have played the game with Master Taylor, and beat him, and my old clothes are a token of the victory. I do not like to give servants board wages, though they are cheaper than household bills. But I know they save out of board wages, and so beat me. This shows that it is not the money, but the game which interests me. So about wine. I have it good and dear. I will trouble you to tell me where to get it good and cheap. You may as well give me the address of a shop where I can buy meat for 4p a pound, or sovereigns for 15 shillings apiece. At the game of auctions, docks, shy wine merchants, depend on it there is no winning, and I would as soon think of buying jewelry at an auction in Fleet Street, as of purchasing wine from one of your dreadful needy wine agents such as infest every man's door. Grudge myself good wine? As soon grudge my horse corn. Merci. That would be a very losing game indeed, and your humble servant has no relish for such. But in the very pursuit of saving there must be 100 harmless delights and pleasures which we who are careless necessarily forego. What do you know about the natural history of your household? Upon your honor and conscience, do you know the price of 1 pound of butter? Can you say what sugar costs, and how much your family consumes, and ought to consume? How much lard do you use in your house? As I think on these subjects I own I hang down the head of shame. I suppose for a moment that you, who are reading this, are a middle-aged gentleman, and paterfamilias. Can you answer the above questions? You know, sir, you cannot. Now turn round, lay down the book, and suddenly ask Mrs. Jones and your daughters if they can answer. They cannot. They look at one another. They pretend they can answer. They can tell you the plot and principal characters of the last novel. Some of them know something about history, geology, and so forth. But of the natural history of home nicks, and for shame on you all. Honest soyez. For shame on you. For shame on us. In the early morning I hear a sort of caller joddle under my window, and notice the matutinal milkman leaving his can at my gate. Oh household gods! Have I lived all these years, and don't know the price or the quantity of the milk which is delivered in that can? Why don't I know? As I live, if I live till tomorrow morning, as soon as I hear the call of Lactantius, I will dash out upon him. How many cows? How much milk, on an average, all the year round? What rent? What cost of food and dairy servants? What loss of animals, and average cost of purchase? If I interested myself properly about my pint or hogshead, whatever it be, of milk, all this knowledge would ensue, all this additional interest in life. What is this talk of my friend, Mr. Lewis, about objects at the seaside, and so forth? *** objects at the seaside? Objects at the area bell. Objects before my nose. Objects which the butcher brings me in his tray. Which the cook dresses and puts down before me, and over which I say grace. My daily life is surrounded with objects which ought to interest me. The pudding I eat or refuse, that is neither here nor there, and, between ourselves, what I have said about batter pudding may be taken cum grano. We are not come to that yet, except for the sake of argument or illustration. The pudding, I say, on my plate, the eggs that made it, the fire that cooked it, the tablecloth on which it is laid, and so forth are each and all of these objects a knowledge, of which I may acquire a knowledge of the cost, and production of which I might advantageously learn. To the man who does know these things, I say the interest of life is prodigiously increased. The milkman becomes a study to him, the baker a being he curiously and tenderly examines. Go, Louis, and clap a hideous sea anemone into a glass. I will put a cabman under mine, and make a vivisection of a butcher. O lairs, peanuts, and gentle household gods, teach me to sympathize with all that comes within my doors. Give me an interest in the butcher's book. Let me look forward to the ensuing number of the grocer's account with eagerness. It seems ungrateful to my kitchen chimney not to know the cost of sweeping it, and I trust that many a man who reads this and muses on it will feel, like the writer, ashamed of himself, and hang down his head humbly. Asterisk Eastside Studies. By G. H. Lewis. Now, if to this household game you could add a little money interest, the amusement would be increased far beyond the mere money value, as a game at cards for sixpence is better than a rubber for nothing. If you can interest yourself about sixpence, all life is invested with a new excitement. From sunrise to sleeping you can always be playing that game with butcher, baker, coal merchant, cabman, omnibus man, nay, diamond merchant and stockbroker. You can bargain for a guinea over the price of a diamond necklace, or for a 16% in a transaction at the stock exchange. We all know men who of this faculty who are not ungenerous with their money. They give it on great occasions. They are more able to help than you and I who spend ours, and say to poor prodigal who comes to us out at elbow, my dear fellow, I should have been delighted. But I have already anticipated my quarter, and am going to ask Scrooby if he can do anything for me. In this delightful, wholesome, ever novel twopenny game, there is a danger of excess, as there is in every other pastime or occupation of life. If you grow too eager for your twopence, the acquisition or the loss of it may affect your peace of mind, and peace of mind is better than any amount of twopences. My friend, the old clothes man, whose agonies over the hat have led to this rambling disquisition, has, I very much fear, by a too eager pursuit of small profits, disturbed the equanimity of a mind that ought to be easy and happy. Had I stood out, he thinks, I might have had the hat for 3p, and he doubts whether, having given 4p for it, he will ever get back his money. My good Shadrach, if you go through life passionately deploring the irrevocable, and allow yesterday's transactions to embitter the cheerfulness of today, and tomorrow as leaf walk down to the Seine, souse in, hats, body, clothes bag and all, and put an end to your sorrow and sordid cares. Before and since Mr. Franklin wrote his pretty epilogue of The Whistle, have we not all made bargains of which we repented, and coveted and acquired objects for which we have paid too dearly? Who has not purchased his hat in some market or other? There is General McClellan's cocked hat, for example. I dare say he was eager enough to wear it, and he has learned that it is by no means cheerful wear. There were the military beavers of Messigneurs of Orleans, they wore them gallantly in the face of battle, but I suspect they were glad enough to pitch them into the James River and come home in mufti. Ah, Mess Amos! A Jack and Son jacket. I was looking at a bishop the other day, and thinking, my right reverend lord, that broad brim and rosette must bind your great broad forehead very tightly, and give you many a headache. A good easy widowick were better for you, and I would like to see that honest face with a cutty pipe in the middle of it. There is my Lord Mayor. My once dear Lord, my kind friend, when your 2 years' reign was over, did not you jump for joy and fling your chapeau bras out of window? And hasn't that hat cost you a pretty bit of money? There, in a splendid traveling chariot, in the sweetest bonnet, all trimmed with orange blossoms and chantilly lace, sits my Lady Rosa, with old Lord Snowden by her side. Ah, Rosa! What a price have you paid for that hat which you wear, and is your ladyship's coronet not purchased too dear? Enough of hats. Sir, or madam, I take off mine, and salute you with profound respect. Two cadets of the House of Orleans who served as volunteers under General McClellan in his campaign against Richmond. on Alexandrins. Asterisk, asterisk, a letter to some country cousins. Asterisk, this paper, it is almost needless to say, was written just after the marriage of the Prince and Princess of Wales in March, 1863. Dear cousins, be pleased to receive herewith a packet of mails, photographs and copies of Illustrated News, Illustrated Times, London Review, Queen, and Observer, each containing an account of the notable festivities of the past week. If, besides these remembrances of home, you have a mind to read a letter from an old friend, behold, here it is. When I was at school, having left my parents in India, a good-natured captain or colonel would come sometimes and see us Indian boys, and talk to us about Papa and Mama, and give us coins of the realm, and write to our parents, and say, I drove over yesterday and saw Tommy at Dr. Birch's. I took him to the George, apostrophe, and gave him a dinner. His appetite is fine. He states that he is reading Cornelius Nepos, apostrophe, with which he is much interested. His master's report, and see. And though Dr. Birch wrote by the same mail a longer, fuller, and official statement, I have no doubt the distant parents preferred the friend's letter, with its artless, possibly ungrammatical, account of their little darling. I have seen the young heir of Britain. These eyes have beheld him and his bride, on Saturday in Pall Mall, and on Tuesday in the nave of St. George's Chapel at Windsor, when the young Princess Alexandra of Denmark passed by with her blooming procession of bridesmaids, and half an hour later, when the Princess of Wales came forth from the chapel, her husband by her side robed in the purple mantle of the famous order which his forefather established here 500 years ago. We were to see her yet once again, when her open carriage passed out of the castle gate to the station of the near railway which was to convey her to Southampton. Since womankind existed, has any woman ever had such a greeting? At 10 hours' distance, there is a city far more magnificent than ours. With every respect for Kensington Turnpike, I own that the Arc de L'Etoile at Paris is a much finer entrance to an imperial capital. In our black, orderless, zigzag streets, we can show nothing to compare with the magnificent array of the Rue de Rivoli, that enormous regiment of stone stretching for 5 miles and presenting arms before the Tuileries. Think of the late Fleet Prison and Waithman's Obelisk, and of the Place de la Concorde and the Luxor Stone. The finest site in Europe, as Trafalgar Square has been called by some obstinate British optimist, is disfigured by trophies, fountains, columns, and statues so puerile, disorderly, and hideous that a lover of the arts must hang the head of shame as he passes, to see our dear old Queen City arraying herself so absurdly. But when all is said and done, we can show one or two of the greatest sights in the world. I doubt if any Roman festival was as vast, or striking as the Derby Day, or if any imperial triumph could show such a prodigious muster of faithful people as our young princess saw on Saturday, when the nation turned out to greet her. The calculators are squabbling about the numbers of hundreds of thousands, of millions, who came forth to see her, and bid her welcome. Imagine beacons flaming, rockets blazing, yards manned, ships and forts saluting with their thunder, every steamer and vessel, every town and village from Ramsgate to Gravesend, swarming with happy gratulation, young girls with flowers, scattering roses before her, state citizens and aldermen pushing and squeezing and panting to make the speech, and bow the knee, and bid her welcome. Who is this who is honored with such a prodigious triumph, and received with a welcome so astonishing? A year ago we had never heard of her. I think about her pedigree and family, not a few of us are in the dark still, and I own, for my part, to be much puzzled by the allusions of newspaper genealogists and bards and scalds to Vikings, berserkers, and so forth. But it would be interesting to know how many hundreds of thousands of photographs of the fair bright face have by this time made it beloved and familiar in British homes. Think of all the quiet country nooks from Land's End to Caithness, where kind eyes have glanced at it. The farmer brings it home from market, the curate from his visit to the cathedral town, The rustic folk peer at it in the little village shop window. The squire's children gaze on it round the drawing room table. Every eye that beholds it looks tenderly on its bright beauty and sweet artless grace, and young and old pray God bless her. We have an elderly friend, a certain Goody Twashows, who inhabits, with many other old ladies, the union house of the parish of St. Lazarus in Soho. One of your cousins from this house went to see her, and found Goody and her companion crones all in a flutter of excitement about the marriage. The whitewashed walls of their bleak dormitory. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.